Rosie, can you just say hello so that I check that your voice is being recorded?
Hello.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. All right. Well, first off, I wanted to say congratulations on this new and second publication, and even more so for extending your reach to a greater force in female collective consciousness across our ethnic divide as Latinas and into a greater realm of inclusivity. You're now uniting us in greater solidarity in order to enact positive change in this world. For the last 8 years now, I have taken on a moonlighting job that is based on the fact that I believe and teach that the beauty standard perpetuated in our media is a commercialized, unattainable standard defined by markets, fads, socioeconomic effects, and not at all by feasibility, ethnicity, or capability. Therefore, it is truly an honor for me to do this interview with you and to have a woman who I feel is actively engaged in raising consciousness here today on my blog. So thank you.
Thank you.
So my first question is, I love that you use the term intention often in the intro in your book, and daily exercises such as 109, get clear on your intention. I find that doing so many things for the wrong reasons often yields negative, unclear, fruitless results. But also intention declares one willingness to commit. Can you elaborate on your use of the word intention and why is it so important to establish what exactly one's intention is before you begin this kind of work?
Words in our language or in any language are I have decided. And I think that once you decide something, there comes a clarity. And with that clarity, usually comes right action. I mean, if you get to the point where you really decide that you're fed up with something, or that you're inspired by something, or that something has to change, when you have that clarity of thought, it really guides your intention. And so I think it's important. I think so often we act in ways that are just sitting in what we've already known.
Mm-hmm.
So we repeat bad mistakes and we fail to have growth just because we've made no decision or no decision to get out of it. And by that, we've consequently made a decision to stay in it.
Another aspect of your book that I found myself nodding my head into agreement with were the multiple times you emphasized the vital importance of stepping into discomfort in order to yield great reward. For example, this quote, "Resist the urge to turn away from the daily exercises that seem daunting. Those are often the exercises you need the most." So here's a question, Rosie. How do you deal with someone who says that they want to alter their way of thinking for the better, but they simply don't take the actions necessary to make that change because of the discomfort? In other words, can you speak to the concept of being ready?
So I think that I can work with women as much as I want to try to help them reach self-acceptance, but until they're ready to reach self-acceptance, it's a moot point. And I heard Maya Angelou speak years ago that said, when the student is ready, the teacher appears.
Yeah.
In my high school teaching career.
Yes.
So that was really inspiring to me as an actual teacher. But I don't think that our teachers in life are just sort of the traditional teachers
right.
We think of. I also think their experiences and mm-hmm. those kind of things. But not only does a teacher need to be cognizant of when her student's ready, but I think that students of life, which are all of us, need to be ready for when our lesson is there to grab us by the throat and teach us. And that lesson, like I said, isn't always a physical person, but nonetheless, we need to be ready for it, and that really involves intention.
You actually make reference to that in one of the exercises in the book when you heard Maya Angelou, and I was like, oh, this is so absolutely right, the whole concept of being ready. And that's why I really love the... There was a couple of things. It was not only your focus on intention, but also you focus more than once in a couple of different exercises about the concept of presence and being fully invested in the here and now. I think that is somewhat disarming the power of the past you know, and what that has on you and the ideas that you might have about the future, and that our noisy minds and negative perceptions of our bodies might be, you know, kind of keeping us caught in. A lot of spiritual leaders also emphasize the value of presence. So I think that when a woman's kind of caught up in past or the ideas of future, it's so,
right.
You know, how do you wake up to the, basically to the now?
Well, I'll just say this about now. I think we so often exist backwards or forwards, and it really keeps us from delighting in life. I think that if we are in a place where we can be absorbed in the now, we can often release from our preoccupations of dissatisfaction. So we can release from, am I the skinniest person in the room, or am I the prettiest person in the room, if we really engage in the conversation that we're in that moment, or the artwork that we're doing in that moment. Like, if we can just engage in the moment, it becomes a really expansive and forgiving place.
Excellent. So the next question I have for you, Rosie. Many of us are familiar with the foods and habits that are poisonous to our body, such as smoking, excessive alcohol, and illegal drugs. But can you speak more to the emotive behaviors that are also poisonous to our self-esteem that you mention in the book, such as gossip and participatory verbal deprecation of our bodies? Can you speak to this and the responsibility we have to the greater female community we engage in?
Absolutely. I think our language is sometimes so dangerous and also really addictive. And so, for example, if I were to go to dinner with a group of girlfriends and sat down at the table and said, oh my God, I just tried to go shopping for an outfit, let's say, for my book tour, and I could just find nothing for my body. My body just doesn't fit in anything. I'm so fat. That what happens is it's like a disease, and everybody goes around the table and then talks about what's wrong with their body.
Yeah.
And I think it's addictive in that women are, in general, are inclined to build community and commonality. And so what we think is helpful and appropriate at the time is for us to throw in our dissatisfaction with our body as well.
Right.
And it just becomes a tsunami of discontent. And I think that one of the first behaviors we really have to disengage from in order to change what is going on with body image and self-perception and self-acceptance in general in our society is for us to change our language. I think that, for, like, if that situation were true, I, for example, need to be less inclined to insult my physical being when I am with a group of girlfriends. And I think that a group of girlfriends need to be less inclined to take up that banner. And so I think one of the very first things that we can do is to become aware of our language and to start to discipline ourselves around it. And in a group, that might mean, I love this example that a friend of mine does or did with her girlfriends. I think they're pretty cured of it now, and so they don't have to do it anymore. But she fined everyone $1 when they said something unpleasant about themselves. And then use that money whenever they went out together to get the group something
special and
And so I love that example. I also think you need to do it with yourself. That when you are saying something unkind, you deliberately say, "No, I'm going to stop that and switch my thinking." And maybe you even find yourself, but it's also, I think, just fine not to find yourself, but just to start raising your level of consciousness about that needs to stop. I mean, the amount of energy and space that takes up. Is absurd. And it also keeps us away from being our best person and doing our best work. We're in such a quagmire of negative thoughts.
Yeah, definitely. We actually think that we're being supportive and identifying, you know, joining in, but we're actually perpetuating and also kind of poisoning ourselves. It's a toxic behavior.
It does no one any good. And if you are operating from that place, you're operating from that place because you are dissatisfied with yourself, not because you're dissatisfied with the other person that you're
trying
to speak about. You are really dissatisfied with yourself, and those are your body's warning signals. So take them and get okay with yourself.
Right. That's great. Yeah, that makes reference to like day 18, the exercise called Have a Comeback, where the mom keeps asking the young woman or telling her that she'd be so much happier if she lost 20 pounds. And the young woman responds, "Don't you mean that you would be much happier, Mom, if I just lost 20 pounds?" That's awesome, I know. Which actually leads to the next question, which was day 14 is entitled Banish, Have You Lost Weight from Your Vocabulary?
Yeah.
That was, it was actually really important to me. It was interesting to read about your position on the role of asking people about weight loss or gain. Actually, it was an aha moment for me. I have always been straight up asked about weight gain by extended family members. And recently I was considering the irritation I've had with coworkers, verbal responses to my weight loss, frustration that existed for many of the reasons you listed in that exercise. However, I had only considered the better, more responsible way to ask in my mind, instead of your notion, which is that only immediate family and personal family has the right to ask, and otherwise, weight and body size are personal topics that are not up for discussion. As I think about it, the reason it was an aha moment was, yeah, internal body, organs, fluids, muscles, and most of all, fat. What's more personal than that?
Yeah. I just don't think anybody has the right to bring up body weight. I mean, I just don't think it's appropriate, and I find it really offensive.
Yeah.
And I do think it's appropriate for people who really love you and in those really close relationships to say, how are you feeling?
Right.
Are you feeling healthy? Is there a way I can support your health?
Right, yeah.
I think that's okay, depending on delivery. But I just think that when we bring up weight, what we're saying is we have an idea of how your body should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? We don't live in your body.
That's right. That's right. No, it made perfect sense.
And we really don't have the right to have that idea.
Right.
I feel really strongly about that. And it's interesting because somebody will mention to me, yeah, I've lost 20 pounds. Mm-hmm. And I'll be like, I had no friggin' clue. Like, I tend to not notice.
Right.
Body.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciate that I don't notice body.
Right.
In that way. And I think that when we mention weight in any way to a person, we don't know the lens of their experience.
Right.
And because body is so sensitive, we don't know what we're instigating in our comments.
Right.
It's a really dangerous place to go.
Well, for me, that was a real learning curve moment. It was, you know, my mind hadn't been open to the concept of, no, just don't, like, that's not even. It was more like, well, yes, I was offended, and I'm thinking, well, everybody's like, well, why, you know, and these are people who never even say hello to me. I haven't seen them since last June, and, you know, and it's also an implication that perhaps I must have really looked bad the way I was, you know. There's for me, it was a real learning curve moment to read that, and I agreed with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
Okay, the next question is, power that we give a thing such as food. Your day 64, don't demonize food, was another aha moment for me, especially when I remember a few years ago being in the school cafeteria and eyeing a Snickers pie dessert and addressing it out loud as, hey, there's Satan on a plate. My coworker and I had a chuckle because I was about to be tortured in a state of pleasurable pain. But in reality, what I had done was metaphorically make myself the defeated victim yet again, and the pie the powerful contender, knowing full well that the inertia the pie slice would eventually give me was a very active reason for my depression and anxiety at the time. In addition, my addressing food in that way perpetuated and wages a war with food and our bodies, when instead we should be living in harmony with the vessel that maintains us and food that nourishes us.
Right. I think that's really well said. I mean, I think you said it better than I do. So could we put that in the book?
No. But you had it in that exercise 64, don't demonize food. And I'm reading that. I'm like, but there's bad food, right? And I'm reading and I'm thinking, yeah. Yeah, because what I just did was, I made myself the victim again.
Yeah.
You know, I just made it super stronger than me.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that certainly there was food that maybe we know doesn't make us feel well. And,
right.
You know, eating it makes us grumpy. Like, I love ice cream, but if I eat too much ice cream, I feel like crap. But that's not about the food being evil. That's probably about me having just a certain level of lactose intolerance.
Right.
So how I approach ice cream, because I definitely want it if I see it, is, you know, given what I've eaten already today, like, did I have a hot chocolate or
right.
with milk, how much can I enjoy?
Right.
Without feeling unwell. And I think that in general, that's, you know, there may be some things that we can never enjoy without feeling unwell.
Right.
And that's okay. That just means that food doesn't really agree with me.
Right.
Mean that it holds cower or taunting over us. You know, it just, you know, it's just food.
Yep.
If we make it more than that, we're really paralyzing ourselves.
Right. I think part of self-acceptance is also breaking those paradigms that we have in our mind about good and bad. Well, on to the next topic. I just wanted to share in the hopes that it would just be another way of living artfully and loving your body. Part of what I did was I don't know if you've heard of Tom Rath's book, Strength Finders 2.0.
It's basically, yeah, I've done it.
Me too. And so, and what I love that I had, you know, that book sitting there while I was reviewing your book, and in his intro, and it just was exactly what you're emphasizing, he states that he and his team of Gallup scientists were tired of living in a world that revolved around fixing our weaknesses. Society's relentless focus on people's shortcomings had turned into a global obsession. What's more, we had discovered that people have several more time potential for growth when they invest energy in developing their strengths instead of correcting their deficiencies. Well, as a part of my process of self-acceptance, I took the StrengthFinders 2.0 survey and learned my 5 strengths to focus my attention on and better understand myself. You, Rosie, apply this very same principle to your practice, stating that women need to discover their passions and that if we were to do an analysis of how much time we've spent derailed from pursuing our passions, and I think you had an exercise or something, I can't remember how much time you had spent, was it hair or the blow dryer or some, yeah, and so I love that. I just love the whole concept of focusing on the things we can do well instead of trying to fix things we perhaps wrongly perceive are not right.
Well, I agree. I think that I am fortunate in that I was able to get over my body at a younger age simply because I found other stuff that was more important
right.
to spend time with.
Right.
And I think that really got me out of my head mm-hmm. In that negative way and got me into my heart in a really positive way. And so it wasn't so much that all of a sudden I loved my look 100%. It was that all of a sudden my look didn't matter nearly.
That's right.
Everything else I had to do.
That's right. There were more important things, right?
Yeah.
That has, and
I think that for me, really a cornerstone of getting over myself was getting into something else.
Right. Okay. I think when we work with young women, too, that becomes a really critical part of seeing their progress is just trying to help them see their light and their brilliance and their strength. Have them focus a lot more energy on those disciplines and subjects that they fall in love with. So, Rosie, you mentioned that some of your wonderful ideas came from the experience with teaching a seminar on body image at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, and wonderful alliances with professionals in the field that you made, such as Dr. Amy Combs. Out of any of the ideas or exercises or tools that you received from these such experiences or allies, are there any that you yourself have tried that you were most affected by? Which ones were they?
I think one of my favorite moments was teaching class and having a student, Erin Lederer, who's just a really cool young woman. She had this aha moment in the middle of class. It was actually a day that Julie Hall, who I mentioned in the book, was in class being a guest speaker. And Erin had this moment where she said, "Oh my God, our bodies are like vehicles."
Yes, I read that.
We need a different vehicle
That's right.
for where we're going. Like sometimes you need the SUV and sometimes you need the fast little sports car.
Yeah.
So we're all given a vehicle with the intention of getting us through our lives, and some greater being knows what vehicle we need.
That's fantastic,
You know, we should embrace the vehicle we have and go, like, and understand that this is about taking us on our journey into our destinations and the way that we need to go, and not about the way this vehicle looks on the road.
Right.
And that was this really cool aha moment to witness, but I also was like, that is a really accessible way for people to understand this, and I just love that moment.
Yeah.
Another teachable moment for me came from a student, too, and that was earlier this year. I was really struggling with, we have a baby boy at home, well, who's now a toddler boy.
Right.
I work, but I also am his primary caregiver in terms of, like, the person who's home during the day. I should, primary caregiver sounds wrong, so let's not say that or my husband will get upset.
Oh.
I'm the person who sort of is with him during the day.
Right.
And so one of the things that became really real to me was that my ability to get ready in the morning really shrunk. You know, and so what I was doing was he and I would go to the gym and I would show at the gym, and that's where I got ready for the day. And I'd want to hurry at the gym, and so I would leave with my hair wet and sort of out of control, and then would find when I'd go to something later in the day that I didn't look all that professional because I hadn't really done my hair.
Right.
I was really struggling with, you know, how do I work with this little time with my reality? And so I thought, you know what, this would be so much easier if I just got my hair straightened. Like, I could just leave with wet hair and it'll dry without some, you know, something sticking up. And, but then I really struggled with, well, am I allowed to get my hair straightened if I'm the body image lady?
Right? Oh, no.
Is that okay for me?
Right.
And I was really worried about the message it would send versus what would be convenient for me, and was just struggling. And one of my students, I posted about on my blog about sort of the struggle and that I didn't know what to do because on the one hand, I don't want to send a message that my hair is inadequate and I need to change it.
Right, right.
But on the other hand, the reality is I don't really have time to do it, and I do understand that I don't always look all that professional by not doing it. And one of my students wrote on my blog and said, you know, what I learned from your class was that we should not do things motivated by what others will think of us, but motivated instead by what will make our life easier. And it doesn't sound like you're doing this because you want other people to think, you know, you're this long brunette.
Right.
But instead, you just want to be able to run out the house a little bit faster with respect for the work that you have to do that day. And so in my worldview, from what you taught me, it'd be okay.
Right.
And it was just this moment where I thought, yes, that's it.
Yep.
Someone else to say that back to me.
Yes.
And what was cool about it was that it was one of my students who said it back to me.
That's fantastic. So it's what we can hope for.
I do have to relearn the math.
Actually related to it. That's a wonderful experience you had with one of your students. No, that's wonderful. It's perfect. Next, there were just words that for me were very important, and I guess I'll just say what they are, and then you can decide if you want to say something about them or not. Your appreciation of process. The other one was being agents of global change and acts of service to others. And the last word that I put down, which was also super important to me, was mentoring and the responsibility we have to shepherd younger women to a healthy state of self-acceptance. So if there's any of those three that you want to elaborate on.
Remind me what the first one was.
Process and journey, and not being fixated on this final product thing, but seeing the validity and educational merit in the journey and the process. Process was the first one. The second was agents of global change, acts of service. And the last one was mentoring and the responsibility we have to shepherding younger women.
So I'll start with process. I think that so often people think that the whole point of life is to get somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get somewhere, we can sit in it and just enjoy it. And I think that the whole point of life is the giving.
Mm-hmm.
It's that journey. That I'm scared that if we think that we have arrived, we'll quit really learning and living.
Right.
You know, we'll just sit back in it. And so I think really the point of life is to be in that moment, expand our understanding of it, and refine who we are, and that we should always be in a process of refining. That is the very essence of living, is that refinement and processing. It's when we think that we've arrived and the world owes us something for that arrival, that things go tragically wrong.
Mm.
And so that's why our existence isn't static, why our relationships aren't static. Like, if you get married and think on that first day, I've arrived at true love.
That's right, yeah.
And you're not always working to refine true love,
then
you're going to end up disappointed. And I think that's sort of just a metaphor for all of our life, that it is that journey, and that you shouldn't look to be done with the journey. Be aware that you're pushing towards the destiny. So that's that. And then with mentoring, I think that we should probably always exist in a state of both being mentored and mentoring.
Yes, I'm a big proponent of the teacher always maintaining a deliberate intention to serve as a student as well.
Life is really cyclical. There's always an opportunity for us to learn, but there's also always an opportunity for us to teach. It's that teacher and that learner sort of coexisting at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That we're always both those things.
Yeah.
And that I think that the rent we pay for living is to fully inhabit both those things. And so even when we feel like, I need a little bit more learning on my journey, we still have plenty to teach.
Right.
And we shouldn't sort of lose sight of that. And in fact, I think that mentoring relationships, even if technically you're the mentor and someone else is the mentee, are really very mutual mentoring moments. You know, just like those two students who really gave me an aha moment. Technically, was I employed to be their teacher? Absolutely. But the reality of it is that what I love about teaching is that I've learned just as much as my students.
That's right, yeah.
Every single day and get just as much, if not more, out of it.
Yeah.
And then I think, you know, the middle concept was this idea of global engagement.
Yeah.
Being active in our world. And I think that really plays to becoming awake to our passion and plugging into it. And there's this wonderful Frederick Buechner quote about how we need to find our deepest gladness and find a way to use our deepest gladness to meet the world's deepest needs in relation to that gladness. And I think that's really it. Like, if all of us could plug into what we're most passionate about and what the world most needs from that passion, then we can really heal our world and move dynamically forward. It doesn't always have to be from that, you know, you could be, what your great gladness is being an entrepreneur and say, well, I don't fit into the world's deepest gladness. That's not true at all. You could absolutely be involved in an entrepreneur activity, you know, that has consciousness.
Right, right.
Sort of aware of what the world's need is in that area.
Right.
I think that all of us, no matter what profession we choose, vocationally or even like mission-wise, can really sort of link those two things. And I think we should try.
Wonderful. Thank you. Oh, that's perfect. Something I think as a teacher, there are so many of your exercises in your book, too, that I could use even in co-ed classrooms that I was actually thinking about, you know, high school, too, versus college, and things that would be so beneficial to educating the whole child and process in that way. You know, like you had, day 31, know your rights. Day 36, don't make unrealistic comparisons. The Photoshop before and after. Day 39, have someone else make a resolution for you. The follow a theme, recognize difference, all of those would be so great for even my co-ed class. So I just want to throw out to listeners the interdisciplinary value of this book, Beautiful You, that you've written. It's just really versatile. And that I have a wish receiving free copies of your book and instructed to leave them in random public places for others to find. Getting extra copies of the book and going out and doing some guerrilla gifting on our own. But here's my wish, which is to leave their copy of the Beautiful You book in a place which young, frustrated women frequent, like a fitting room from a store that doesn't carry any pant sizes over 8. And they do exist because I've been there. And for one such young woman to find it and realize she is actually the national average and is beautiful the way she is because her essential inner self deep down knows this universal truth. And then I had a shameless pitch to collaborate with you more, which is, personally, I'm really interested in women's retreats and have followed a group of powerful women on the blogosphere who go out once a year and they do this blog. I can't remember if it's, I don't think it's Love Bomb or Art Bomb or they're Art Bombers or something is what they call themselves, but I'll find that out. Oh, they're all amazing, intelligent, women who are really developed in their passions, and they get together once a year, and I just have this deep, covetous, positive envy to be a part of such a group, and I imagine being invited to one of their, you know, bomber retreats. They do art, writing, and a lot of empowerment. One of the activities I saw they did was they would write these affirming words on, like, each other with, like, body paint, maybe, like, around the neck, and then photograph each other. You would love it. It's inspired me to do my own one-day women's art retreat on creative consciousness with the Altered books, but I know that on November 6, 2010, from 9 to 5:30 in Statesville, North Carolina, you'll be hosting a one-day workshop on self-awareness empowerment retreat based on Beautiful You. Do you think you'll ever do more of these in the future? And would you ever be up for doing one together?
I'd love to do one with you.
Yeah.
You did a really cool retreat lately.
Yeah, that's the women's art retreat.
I was aching for it. Like, I read it and I had envy, like, for those women who were able to be there. Like, it was like this Oh, I'm so happy to know this exists, and I'm so jealous to know that this exists, and I wish that I were there.
That's how I feel about those bomber women and yours. I was like, I didn't know about this. Why did I find out so late?
It was meant for me. How could I not know? And that's why I thought about your retreat, like I didn't know it was happening. And then
yeah.
It happened, and I was like, oh, I was meant to be there, and I wasn't. I'm simply meant to be at another one.
Right.
I think we should plan one together.
Yeah, I was reading the description of yours and the writing prompts and the journaling, and I just thought, oh, wow, just imagine the altered books combined with that and just how awesome it would be. Yeah, I'll have to send you these links.
Where did you do yours? Okay, this is probably off-interview.
Okay, folks, I'm signing off now. I want to say thank you to all of you. And a very special thank you to Rosie Molinari, author of Beautiful You, A Daily Guide to Radical Self-Acceptance.